Standish with us on the line from Redding, California, or thereabouts. And Mark is quite an interesting fellow, as you know. We've had him on the air before, and we'll have him on the air again. But Mark, back in the 90s, went to Aztec, and he'll tell us in this interview why. And he visited the crash scene. It was all because of a book that he read called UFO Crash at Aztec. And it was written by the late, great Wendell Stevens, along with William Steinman. And that book, I believe, is still available, at Amazon at least. And it was quite an inspiring book. As you'll hear, when Mark talks to us, he checked everything out. And Wendell and William had it pretty much down right as far as the facts about the crash scene and things like that. Anyway, Mark, thanks for joining us, and I look forward to hearing this story. You were quite taken with this book, I take it.
Well, the book was published by published jointly by Wendell Stevens and William S. Steinman. In fact, I've got the ISBN number here for anybody who's trying to find a copy of this. It's 0-934-269-05-X. And anyway, I was kind of intrigued by, you know, these stories of crash retrievals like the one that occurred in Roswell. And apparently this particular crash happened a little less than a year after the Roswell crash. In fact, sort of the funny coincidence in all of this is that it happened on my birthday, March 25th, about 5 years before I was born, so in 1948.
And so what conclusion do we draw, that you were part of that Aztec crash and E.T. among us?
Yeah, I know we were joking earlier about how I might have been a reincarnated alien or something, but anyway, so I picked up a copy of the book, and it turned out that a year or two after that, I was living in Southern California at the time. I had picked up a ZF transaxle out of a 74 Pantera that I needed to have rebuilt. And I had a little Fiero that I was contemplating turning into some kind of a kit car project, you know, make it look like a Ferrari or something. And so I decided that I would take out the passenger seat in this Fiero, put a piece of plywood on the floor of the passenger side, and basically strap down this giant transaxle on the floor of the Fiero and drive cross country up to a spot in Illinois where the ZF company had a transaxle repair center. Apparently, some of the drivetrain components for the Corvette that was, I think it was a C5 Corvette that had kind of a split drivetrain where the transmission was in the back, also was using some ZF components. So they set up a repair installation here in the United States. It was called ZF of North America, I believe. Anyway, so I was going to drive cross-country to drop off this transmission because it seemed like it'd be cheaper and more reliable than sending something this big and heavy through the mail or with UPS. And I figured as long as I was going to do that, I would pass down through New Mexico where I had some relatives living in the area of Clovis and Albuquerque. And this particular site was right along the way. I also went up and visited the area around the Archuleta Mesa in Dulce, New Mexico.
Oh, really? You'll have to tell me about that, too.
Yeah, it was a very strange experience. But anyway, in the book by Wendell Stevens and Steinman, on pages 32 and 33, there was actually a map in there showing where the crash location occurred. And it's probably about two-thirds of the way up a canyon called Hart Canyon. And I actually... you know, by looking at the topography and the map, plus the map that I had, and the fact that there's an awful lot of petroleum industry drilling operations in this area, so it wasn't too hard to have or to run across someone who could say, oh, yeah, you go down this way, and you make a right, and you follow it out, and you'll... So and it just so happens that it's sort of a tributary canyon off of a much larger canyon for, let's see, it looks like the Animas River, which kind of comes in from the north into the town of Aztec itself. And so the crash location is actually a little bit north and to the east of the city or the town of Aztec. And the book, the cover of the book actually has a photograph on the front of it that shows kind of a low cliff, rock escarpment that's just immediately to the east of where the crash occurred. And one of the landmarks that's described in the map of the actual crash site, it's on the next page, page 34, it actually shows a large concrete block. Now, there's been some debate about what this concrete block was for, whether it was used as the foundation for some kind of a crane that they literally installed overnight to give them a support for lifting pieces of this craft onto a number of flatbed trailers. The biggest problem they had, according to the book, was this 100-foot diameter saucer, which had kind of a spherical crew compartment buried right at the center of it, and the crew compartment was about 18 feet in diameter, more of it sort of sticking out above the center line of the craft than below. It was essentially a seamless looking vehicle, and the only thing that the only access point that they had were a number of mirrored glass panels on the upper part of the crew compartment, one of which appeared to have been broken. And there's no specifics about what may have caused that, whether it was a meteorite impact or whether this thing had been shot at, but they could not figure out how to get into this thing to break it down and basically transport it across country. And eventually what they did was they found this opening in one of these windows. They took a long stick and they started poking at some of the buttons that they saw in the crew compartment, and one of them actually caused a kind of a hatchway to drop down from the underside of the craft. And so that's how they were eventually able to get access to this vehicle. And William Steinman apparently tracked down and interviewed a number of people who'd been involved in photographing the crash for the military, who were able to describe, you know, what happened, how they logistically supported the removal of the craft from the site. It turns out that Hart Canyon is pretty much, probably about 100 to 200 foot wide dry riverbed that runs sort of in a west-southwest to east-northeast sort of direction. And then it makes an abrupt turn to the north right at this rock escarpment that I was describing earlier. So the one outstanding landmark on this particular site is this large cement block that seems to have been a part of this removal operation. And so I actually found that. And in fact, I'm looking at the site on Google Earth right now. And for your listeners, I can actually give them the coordinates of this cement block. It's 36 degrees, 51 minutes, 58 seconds, and 0.78 inches north by 108 degrees, 1 minute, 4 seconds, and 0.73 inches west at an elevation of just under 6,000 feet above sea level.
Now, you actually saw this block yourself in person.
Yes, I did. That cement block was still there in about 91 or 92 when I passed through the area. Of course, it's all sort of, you know, dilapidated now, covered with moss and graffiti and things like that. I don't think anybody there really appreciates or understands what this thing was.
Mark, can you give our listeners a little bit of your impression of the place?
Looked around the site. In the book, the person who eventually found the site, I believe it was probably William Steinman himself, said that there were areas of the ground that appeared to have been scorched. Rocks that had discoloration on them. And in my, you know, I've always been kind of a rock hound. You know, I grew up in parts of Arizona and did a lot of fossil hunting and things, and so I spent a lot of time trying to recognize different kinds of geology, different kinds of rocks, and the things that I saw that might have been perceived as scorched rocks really looked to me as though they were rocks that had just experienced a lot of weathering, probably had a high iron content in them, and so the iron content, it tends to corrode and rust and turn sort of a brownish color. So it does look scorched, although I think it's really just a patina from the iron oxide that's sort of leaching out of the rock itself rather than some kind of a temperature problem or some exposure to higher temperature. And the way that I tried to sort this out in terms of validating whether or not that really was the case was I went several hundred yards in every other direction to see whether there were also rocks in those areas that exhibited these same kind of features, and that's exactly what I found. So it was fairly uniform throughout the area. There were a couple of, it looked like pieces of old rusty rebar with some steel plates welded to the end of them, and there were a lot more of these found at the time that William Steinman located the crash site, and some of them appeared to have been, according to his testimony, appeared to have been welded together into what would amount to sort of a, I guess it would be like a three-sided pyramid sort of thing, where they took the, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, probably eight rods, welded them into like a little triangular-shaped pyramid with pads in different areas to support the craft or hold it up off the ground so they could get underneath it and through this doorway, because it was right on the ground. It's kind of crashed, made an impact on one side of Hart Canyon, and then sort of bounced back into the air and then came to rest on the other side, the north side of Hart Canyon, coming in from, I think it was the southeast, if I'm not mistaken. The soils in this area are extremely sandy, and the area that's just to the north of Hart Canyon where this thing came to rest really isn't much more solid in terms of footing than the actual floor of this dry riverbed called Hart Canyon itself. So it's kind of interesting to be there. I didn't expect to find little pieces of foil with alien writing on them or anything like that, but it did appear as though something had happened there at one time, and it's really kind of hard to tell based on what I found that it had anything to do with the impact of, you know, a craft from some other solar system.
But so potentially what you saw up there years later were items, small little items, that might have been used in the retrieval of the craft.
Yes. Yeah, and that was the assertion that was made in the book. I mean, it seems pretty odd that you would be out in the middle of the desert, as it were, and find this large cement block. I would have estimated that it was, it was hard to tell how deep it went down below the soil, but it was at least 3 feet above the ground when I was there. And I would say it was at least, maybe 15 feet long, about 9 feet wide. So it was a pretty substantial mass of concrete. And it looked as though it had been poured into some kind of a quickly formed, form that was, sort of a mold that mm-hmm. was constructed out of either plywood or wooden planks, because you could see the grain of wood in some of the areas of the concrete itself.
What about those that say, well, that's all oil field debris, because oil field operations go on there?
You know, there are a number of other oil field operations in that area, as I was saying before, but generally if you're thinking of something like this as being a well that's been capped off, you're going to have some kind of a fixture on the top of it, or maybe even a piece of steel pipe that goes down through the middle of it that's been cut off, and then a cap has been welded to the top of it, and there was nothing like that at all. In fact, there wasn't even anything at the site designating that this was part of or property of any kind of an oil company or an oil company operation. It was just a big cement block, just a, 100 feet or so north of this dry riverbed.
Mark, I know you're a very practical, technical guy, but while you're up there, did you feel some vibes, some ambience of what might have happened?
Well, I try to be sensitive to those kinds of things. I did have one of the things that they tell you about the desert as an environment is that it's a really sensitive kind of place. There are places out near Fort Ord in the high desert north of Los Angeles where even now, 60 years later, you can still see the trails left by the tanks that Patton and his people, his troops, left when they were doing training exercises for some of the invasions that occurred during the Second World War. You can still see the tracks left by those tanks. And so, when you look at the environment, one of the things that I tried to do was to see if there were any kinds of marks or things that had sort of filled in over time where the vegetation hadn't really grown back at the same rate as some of the other surrounding areas of mm-hmm. sagebrush and things around there. But it's really hard to tell. I mean, I would imagine that if I was part of a recovery team and there was going to be any question about whether the site had significance down the road, one of the things that I would really go out of the way to do would be to remove as much evidence of any kind of logistical operation as possible. Now, even now when I look at this site on Google Earth, you can see evidence of heavy equipment having moved through the area. Now, to my eye, it looks like something that's happened a little bit more recently. There do seem to be some residual marks that show some kind of activity happened there many years ago. You can see areas where the sort of random distribution of the sagebrush seems to be interrupted with a clear margin in two areas of this particular site that almost suggests some kind of heavy equipment or bulldozer was brought in at some point and something had been moved around. You generally don't expect to see that out in a remote area where there's not a lot of activity going on. But that's not to say that it couldn't have been something that happened, in the 50 years since then because of all the oil drilling activity that's going on in the area, whether it's a survey crew in a Jeep or, somebody bringing some pipe in to, connect a newly drilled oil derrick to a supply system. So it's really hard to tell. There's all kinds of piping going through the entire canyon. So it's a very active site in terms of the oil industry. It's kind of a toss-up in terms of whether anything that you can see there geographically is a result of some kind of logistics operation for moving the craft. One of the things they did mention in the book that I thought was kind of interesting was that the craft was apparently assembled in pie-shaped sections, but the joining of the different metal components was so seamless, so perfect. It was almost as though the pieces had been all brought together and then the entire craft had been put on a giant lathe and everything had been smoothed out so one piece to the next was so perfectly smooth you literally couldn't see the seams between the different parts of the craft. And it wasn't until after they gained access to the craft that they actually found a number of interlocking key-like mechanisms that would allow them to disengage one segment from the next, and the whole thing came apart like a big puzzle. And they were able to break it down, stack the pieces, put them under a big tarp on a flatbed truck, one or more flatbed trucks, and haul them off. There's some indication that after the Roswell crash, the military had established something called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, or IPU.
Tell me about that.
Well, they claim that this was a scientific branch of the military. It was based out of Camp Hale in Colorado. Now, the other thing that they talk about is the fact that some of these things were transported to a base up in Colorado, and that it was then flown from there to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was in or near Dayton, Ohio. But
and well, Mark, you mentioned Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and you're no stranger to that area. You actually have a painting of Billy Mitchell, or did, on display at Wright-Patterson.
Well, that's right. There is a painting. I don't know if the building itself is open to the general public, but it was the Billy Mitchell or General Billy Mitchell Memorial Logistics Center for B-1 and B-2 systems in the Air Force. It's the building that where all of the data processing and logistical direction for supplying the B-1 bomber and the B-2 bomber systems throughout the Air Force. It's where all the coordination for that activity occurs, and they've got a very large lobby. It's probably 3.5 stories high inside, and there was a request that came to me from a interior design firm back in that area that asked me to do a vertical format 16-by-20-foot mural for that building.
Yeah, Mark, we knew about that. In fact, we know quite a lot about you. Our researchers, our producers have found out that you're a pretty innovative fellow. So this story about taking this transactyls to Illinois in this little car is not unusual for you.
Well, I've done some crazy things. You should have seen the problem with creating a painting of that size in a vertical format in a place like Reading is that it can be pretty expensive to rent an industrial shop space with a ceiling that's over 20 feet high, especially if you're going to create the painting in the same kind of perspective that one would expect to see it in the lobby of this building. And I simply could not find any site in Reading that had over a 20-foot ceiling where I could spend several months doing a painting. And coincidentally, I had a Cadillac Northstar engine, which had also been part of this proposed kit car project. The sad thing about it was that after I got the transmission rebuilt, I was coming into town, moving my Fiero, and a lady pulled out of a side street without looking, and I T-boned her car and totaled my Fiero. So
oh, man, suddenly, after all that trouble.
I know. It was my pride and joy. I just loved that little car, it totaled the Fiero, and so I had
did to it hurt you
for the transmission or the Northstar engine. That was kind of be my yeah. engine transmission combination. And when I put an ad in the paper to sell the Northstar the Northstar engine, turned out I was contacted by a fellow who was interested in buying the engine. The funny thing was he called me from Hawaii, and I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to get this engine to Hawaii? And he said, oh, no, I live near Reading. He says, I'm on vacation, and, I want to see the engine when I get back. So please don't sell it to anybody else. And apparently his wife had a Cadillac. The engine had burned up. And so sold him the engine, and as I'm taking it over to his place, he's got this giant garage with 16.5-foot ceilings. And I said, say, Gary, do you think that maybe... So we made a deal, and he let me spend about the next 8 months assembling this giant scaffold to actually do the painting. And it wound up, if you've ever seen those reversible chalkboards that they have in college where it has sort of a rolling A-frame with two pivot points at each end, and you can flip the chalkboard over to do equations and then, flip it over. Imagine something like that where the pivot point is about 9 feet off the ground and you're using 4x6 lumber and giant casters, and I got a 21-foot long piece of 3-inch steel pipe, and I created a series of trusses on the back of this thing with struts and outriggers that went out to the edge of this 16-by-20-foot stretcher board that was faced with masonite to give me a firm backing. And then I had a custom canvas stitched together by a company that makes boat covers, and stretched the thing over this backing, stapled all, it must have used 3,000 staples around the edges, and put a gesso primer on it and started painting after they'd approved the composition. And the funny thing about it was they wanted the face of Billy Mitchell to be fairly large in this format. His face wound up being something like 6 feet high. And so if you imagine having a picture of your face blown up and every little pore and acne scar from when you were a teenager. You know. And the thing was that Billy Mitchell had a lot of battle scars from the First World War and a lot of pock marks from when he was a teenager. Apparently he had a lot of problems with his skin. And so, you know, I had to be sort of delicate about how I illustrated this gentleman because, you know, after all, I mean, who wants to see that kind of...
3 foot acne. We don't want to see that. Mark, this is an incredible thing you did. In fact, almost everything you've done is pretty incredible. You actually rolled this thing up and drove it across country in a snowstorm.
Now, I had several people that agreed to help me dismantle this thing. I wanted to maintain the 2x2 structure that made up the lion's share of the stretcher framework that this thing would be reassembled on once I got it to Wright-Patterson. And, you know, I couldn't find any truck that was large enough to transport it intact. It would not even fit into a normal semi-truck, and it would have been exorbitantly expensive. I mean, just astronomically expensive to transport all the way to Dayton, Ohio from, you know, Redding, California. So I had to find some kind of innovative way to transport this thing, and so I had an 89 Maxima, and I found that when these cars were shipped over from Japan, they put these brackets on the lower part of the frame, the chassis, that they would use to tie these things down on these big transport ships so they wouldn't move around if the ship encountered rough seas. And so I used those pickup points on the frame to have a steel framework. It was using 3/8 inch thick, 4 inch wide steel plate that I had cut to various dimensions. Basically had a series of bolts that, and grade 10 bolts and grade 12 bolts that extended down from the frame out beyond the bumper and then formed an A-frame that had cross supports on it, all screwed together with these grade 10 bolts. And then it had two pieces of steel that were bent into the shape of like half of an octagon, like the lower half of a stop sign shape. And that was the cradle for a 22-foot-long piece of 10.5-inch diameter sewer pipe with caps on each end. It's sort of a turquoise green PVC pipe of some kind.
You probably got a lot of attention hauling this thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was so funny because every time we came to a stop, I had a friend of mine came up from Las Vegas, and he helped me drive this thing around the clock ahead of a major snowstorm, as you were saying. Across country, up through the Rocky Mountains, through Salt Lake City, and across country like that. And we were racing a snowstorm all the way across the country, and it caught up with us by the time we got to Salt Lake. And we just barely got up the west side of the Rockies, climbing up into the mountains, going into Wyoming. I'd left my snow tires and my chains at home because we didn't have any room in the car because I had to bring all my tools to reassemble this thing once we got on site. But basically, what I had to do was I had to pull all these staples to get this thing off of the Masonite, pulled it free, and then I unscrewed and disassembled the 2x2 stretcher frame that would be the underlying structure for this thing once it got to the base. And I rolled, I basically took all these 2x2s, some of which were 16 and, you know, 20 feet long, wrapped them up into a bundle, and then I wrapped the painting around those 2x2s, sort of like the classic Greek faggot. That's what it was called, a bundle of sticks, which symbolized the strength of union. And then single-handedly had to lift this thing up into the tube that was already above my car. It weighed several hundred pounds, so I could only really lift one end of it at a time and then try to lift the other end, and it would bow, and it didn't want to go in, and I kind of had to bounce the thing, so the whole thing was sort of wobbling up and down like a giant sine wave made out of canvas and sticks. And, you know, eventually fed this thing into this giant tube, got it all the way in, and then ran home, took a shower, jumped in the car, and headed for Reno, Nevada, where I met up with my buddy. And the funniest part of the whole thing was when people would stop at gas stations and they'd say, You've got some deep sea fishing rigs in there, right? You're going deep sea fishing. You've got your rod and reels in there, right? I had one guy say, my buddy and I, we've been trying to guess what you have in your giant tube there, and we figure it's a full scale drawing, set of drawings for a house, right? Like giant blueprints or something.
Mark McCandlish is our guest. And Mark, in the second half hour here, I wanted you to tell us about your cryptodulcet. In the middle of the night. I think people will enjoy what you have to say. And we'll talk about Area 51 too. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away. I want to talk to you about the Aztec Symposium. It takes place in Aztec, New Mexico. It'll be the 14th annual one, by the way, and it's put on by the Friends of the Library. It's a good benefit. And the interesting thing about this is it's not expensive. You can go all day on Saturday, March 26th, for only $25. And there's senior citizens discounts. And if you're a first responder or a military person, you get in free. And now they have a Friday night get-together as well and a fine, fine meal. And that's only $15. And there's a senior citizens discount there as well. Go to the website and check it all out and register. It's AztecUFO.com. AztecUFO.com. You'll find the speaker lineup and all the details. That's AztecUFO.com. That's AztecUFO.com. We're talking with Mark McCandlish, and Mark, you know, you've had quite a career in aerospace, doing project drawings and paintings, et cetera, et cetera. If you had a chance to draw, or you had an assignment to draw a picture of the craft at Aztec, what do you think it would look like?
Well, this was a classic flying saucer. In fact, the closest thing that I've seen that would resemble the appearance of this craft in terms of its general proportions, its coloration, the contours of the saucer-shaped portion of the craft. If you were to, you could probably find this on the internet, on YouTube or one of those sites that goes back and reviews old movies. But the flying saucer that these astronauts use in the film Forbidden Planet, which I believe was produced by the Disney Studios, It had almost exactly the same proportions in almost every respect as the saucer that was described and portrayed, you know, probably through model work in that film. In fact, that was one of the things that was so surprising about that film was that, and I believe it was produced the year I was born in 1953, starring Leslie Nielsen, who passed away recently.
Mm-hmm.
Even the access ramp that is described in Forbidden Planet on this vehicle was structured in exactly the same way as the one that the scientists found during the recovery of the Aztec crash. So you have to ask yourself if there weren't people who, even back then in the film industry, were being prepared for what a lot of us believe is a kind of acclimation of, you know, the Earth's population to the possibility that, yes, indeed, we're being visited by entities from other star systems. And that's certainly, I mean, there's just so many, the proportions of the craft, the color, the access ramp, maybe even some of the internal controls. I'd have to go back and check, but it's just so coincidental. It doesn't seem to me as though
art imitates life or life imitates art. I'm not sure. Anyway, it seems like we're being prepared for, you know, final disclosure announcements, and then nothing ever happens.
Well, you know, I think I've told you that in the course of my research into this whole area that I've encountered some really unusual things.
I understand you used to listen to late night radio and UFO shows. And it wasn't Art Bell, it was Billy Goodman.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, he he had the program, I think it was called the Billy Goodman Happening.
Mark, I know Billy Goodman very well. He used to follow me on the air at KVEG in Las Vegas, AM 840.
Is that right?
I was on from 10 to midnight, and he was midnight on. I did an occasional UFO show, but basically I was an entertainment and mass appeal general subjects host. But Billy, he had quite a successful format.
Wow.
There.
Well, whatever happened to Billy? Is he still around?
Passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear
had
that.
Had cancer.
Oh,
lived in Providence,
no.
Rhode Island, I believe. Yeah, we'll miss him. He was quite a talent. Yeah, Gloria Euphoria, who used to help him, she's in contact with me. She still lives in Southern California. Ted Rice, the producer of that show at one time. Ted still lives in Las Vegas. Cosmos on YouTube. Check him out. You didn't go up to Area 51 with him, up to Groom Lake, did you? I mean, he chartered a bus, took a lot of people up there.
Well, not with Billy Goodman, but I did go up there on my own.
Yeah, Norio Hayakawa went up there with Billy Goodman one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. I know that Sean David Morton, who I also know, had gone up there several times and caught the attention of the security people there from Wackenhut. And in fact, I found, unfortunately, that there's a very clear and obvious relationship between the county sheriff's office that kind of patrols the highways in that area and the security personnel for Area 51, because one of the other little trips that I made in my Fiero was up to where the mailbox is on that road that kind of leads down mm-hmm. to the northern gate for that complex.
Yeah, the mailbox is to nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, in fact, I didn't see any signs that said you can't go beyond this point, so I drove right down to the point where it says, you can't go beyond this point, and the use of deadly force is authorized. So I got out and took some pictures of the terrain and just sort of in a souvenir kind of sense, and got back into my car, got back on the highway, and I got stopped three times by the county sheriff. Had written tickets every single time for going over the speed limit when I wasn't going over the speed limit. And the clear message there was, we don't like you poking the boundaries of our area over here. So there's not much you can do about something like that, and especially when you live hundreds of miles away. It's not like you can drive over there three times to make an appearance mm-hmm. and make a pleading and then come back later and fight it in court and all that kind of stuff. It's just too expensive. So you pay the bill. And that was the penalty I paid for poking around that area. But
did you find anything else while
you're
there?
I actually went there because there was a young fellow that worked at the bank that I was using at that time, who said that he'd heard these stories on the radio also, and he and some of his friends had decided to go out there and have a case of beer and kick back and wait to see if they could see a UFO. And he said that they got a little bit too tipsy, and they decided they'd take off across the desert and see how close they could get to the boundary of the area before somebody came up and gave them what for. This kid said that as they were getting close to one of the boundaries, and there's not much you can do about something like that, and especially when you live hundreds of miles away. It's not like you can drive over there three times to make an appearance mm-hmm. and make a pleading and then come back later and fight it in court and all that kind of stuff. It's just too expensive. So you pay the bill. And that was the penalty I paid for poking around that area.
Did you find anything else while you're there?
Well, I actually went there because there was a young fellow that worked at the bank that I was using at that time, who said that he'd heard these stories on the radio also, and he and some of his friends had decided to go out there and have a case of beer and kick back and wait to see if they could see a UFO. And he said that they got a little bit too tipsy, and they decided they'd take off across the desert and see how close they could get to the boundary of the area before somebody came up and gave them what for. And he said that they encountered a brilliant, ball of light approached their vehicle at a high rate of speed, stopped, hovered not too far from their location, and they all jumped out of the car and they were looking at this thing, and somewhat afraid and mystified by what they were seeing, and then right as they were watching this thing, it turned transparent and disappeared.
Wow.
And to hear this young man tell a story, I mean, you could see, his eyelids kind of flutter and his hands start to shake, because he'd obviously experienced something that really left an impression on him. And that was, in addition to all the other stories that I'd heard about that area, it was something that motivated me to go out there and look at that. This brilliant ball of light approached their vehicle at a high rate of speed, stopped, hovered not too far from their location, and, they all jumped out of the car and they were looking at this thing and, somewhat afraid and mystified by what they were seeing, and then right as they were watching this thing, it turned transparent and disappeared.
Wow.
And to hear this young man tell a story, I mean, you could see, his eyelids kind of flutter and his hands start to shake, because he'd obviously experienced something that really left an impression on him. And that was, in addition to all the other stories that I'd heard about that area, it was something that motivated me to go out there and
happen to you while you were around Area 51?
Not while I was there. I actually had more high strangeness after leaving the Aztec area and heading over towards Dulce.
Yeah, I want to get to Dulce, because here on our page we have a picture by a cell phone from a person who lives there, who has a picture of it's a flying saucer right by the mesa, right by the Archelon Mesa.
You're kidding?
No.
That's amazing.
No, not kidding. So let's talk about your trip to Dulce. I think you made it up to the top of the mesa.
Well, I traveled across the northern half of New Mexico after leaving Aztec, which is, it's not too far from a geographical landmark called Shiprock. It's Aztec is sort of northeast of that location. And so I proceeded east from Aztec towards the highways that would take me into an area of the, I think it's called the Jicarilla Indian Reservation,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of a reservation. It's probably, several hundred square miles, kind of in a long rectangle that sort of runs north and south, but it comes to within, just a few miles of the town of Dulce itself. And so I had to catch a road that approached that area from the south and came up into the Dulce area. I had a friend, a UFO researcher, who was the fellow that I initially contacted after I came into this information about the alien reproduction vehicle that we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Paul Shepard, and he's since kind of left the whole UFO research field, but he was friends with the son of Dennis Weaver, the actor who used to play McCloud on TV.
Yeah, I know Dennis.
Dennis Weaver had some property just over the border in Colorado, just north of where the Archuleta Mesa and Dulce is located. And he and his son, I believe his son's name was Rusty, had an awful lot of UFO sightings from what Paul Shepard had told me. And, in fact, Paul Shepard was pretty good friends with Rusty. So I had done a little research in the Los Angeles office of the U.S. Geological Survey, which had topographical maps of just about every part of the United States, with the exception of Area 51. That was the one area I couldn't find any maps for. But they did have plenty of maps for the area down around Dulce, and Paul and a number of his friends had decided to mount an expedition to go down there and see whether there was anything to the story of the Archuleta Mesa and the things that were alleged to have happened in or around Dulce or beneath the mesa in some kind of an underground complex. Several of the people that Paul took with him were some researchers who had one fellow had developed a very sophisticated system, very similar to ground-penetrating radar, but it would use basically high volume multi-frequency sound broadcasts using large speakers, like the kind you would see being used on stage at some of these rock concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a number of power systems that were sort of independently driven. They could take and put a speaker on a kind of a platform and lay it on the ground, and they'd have a remote control device that would allow them to time the moment of broadcast and the frequencies that were transmitted through these speakers, which of course were pointed down towards the ground. And they would go to four different, you know, specific locations, and then they would sit right in the middle of these the placement of these four speakers, and they would broadcast these various speakers, these frequencies into the ground, and it was all being listened to by a device that they sort of embedded into the ground right in the center of where those speakers were located. And so by sending these different frequencies into the ground rather than using like a, you know, a shotgun shell or some kind of a small explosive charge to send out a pulse of sound through the geography of the,
mm-hmm.
of the ground, they would use sound of different frequencies. And it was almost like using an ultrasound to image a child in the womb of a pregnant individual. And so they were able to get a very clear picture of what was happening beneath the Arch of Loma Mesa. They had these speakers that were positioned at some fairly wide distances from one another. And they came back with data that suggested very strongly that there was a complex beneath the Arch of Loma Mesa that rivaled the size of New York City. They said that it was just an absolutely massive facility. There was no doubt about it. They could see very clear artificial structures beneath the mesa, and that the electrical systems alone, which I guess because of all the conduit and the copper wire and so forth that went from one area to another for transmission of power and telemetry and things like that, was something you would expect to see used in a city in terms of its size. Now, the only explanation I have for their being able to see these particular components is because of the perhaps the electrical resonance of these systems, probably alternating current. They had all this data. They had a Japanese television station that was coming over to review their data. They wanted to do a special program about all of this. You know, the Japanese are very intrigued by this kind of thing. And right before they were supposed to meet with the Japanese, the individual who had this equipment had since gone back to, I guess it was Phoenix or Tempe, Arizona, where he lived. His home was broken into. All of the data, all of his equipment, everything, you know, like almost $500,000 worth of equipment was stolen. And so they had absolutely no record of what they'd actually seen with their own eyes in terms of the data they collected. So, you know, somebody was obviously very, worried about that information getting out. Now, this was all sort of sitting in the back of my mind as I'm, you know, in my little Fiera.
Yeah. When did they do this?
That would have been around 1989, I believe it was.
Okay.
1989 or early 1990. And so around 1991, when I decided that I had to take this Pantera transaxle back east for this rebuild, I decided that I would, travel through these areas and see if I couldn't see, you know, I mean, kind of a risky proposition to be going on these, poorly maintained dirt roads through the mountains of New Mexico in a low-slung Fiero.
Yeah.
Ground clearance was a bit of an issue, but I managed to get up on top of the Arch of Loma.
Oh, you actually made it up there, huh?
Yeah. There's a number of roads that I found on some of the Forestry Service maps. It's at the extreme west end of the town of Dulce, which the main part of the town is just one little street with a few stores on it. It's really not a very exciting town by any means. The thing that was so peculiar about Dulce was that it looks like this little hick town out in the middle of nowhere, except that it's got a multi-million dollar Best Western five-star rated hotel just north of the town up on a hillside just below where the Arch of Loma Mesa is. Now, there's only one reason I can think of that they'd have a hotel like that in that location. And that is because either there's something in the area that's drawing in tourists. You know, hunting and fishing is certainly one possibility. But the other possibility, of course, is that you have some high-ranking military dignitaries who are coming to visit a complex under Dulce. You know, they may not want to be underground for 5 weeks, you know. They may not want to be down there under the ground with God knows what's happening down there. They might want, you know, some nicer accommodations above ground. And so that was, you know, kind of my thinking.
Boy, would I love to see those motel records. I mean, who checked in, whose charge cards were used.
Oh, yeah, you know, I thought that's the exact same thing. That's pretty perceptive on your part because, you know, I had thought, you know, about that exact same thing. And so part of the reason that Paul Shepard and his crew were heading down to Dulce was it was sort of a, you know, a multi-purpose trip. One of the other things they were doing was they wanted to head down to Albuquerque to a research facility that was operating down there right outside Kirkland Air Force Base.
I bet you're talking about Sandia Base.
Is that right?
You know, I was almost stationed there in the Army. Last minute they sent me to the Bay Area in San Francisco. Probably a good thing. I might not be alive today. I mean, I'm pretty inquisitive. And,
well, you know, they do an awful lot of dangerous research there, a lot of advanced high-energy weapons.
I don't think the researchers would have hurt me, but maybe my own troops.
Well, anyway, one of the alternate purposes for going down there was to meet with Paul Benowitz, who at the time claiming that he had had a number of encounters throughout the area and also up near the Archuleta Mesa. So apparently Paul Benowitz had traveled up to the Dulce area, and he'd had a four-wheel drive vehicle, and he traveled a certain distance back into the wilderness somewhere around the Archuleta Mesa, and he'd come up to a rise that overlooked a kind of a canyon, and that according to Paul Shepard, he had witnessed the landing of a craft, your stereotypical saucer-shaped craft, which was met by a number of U.S. military vehicles, and there appeared to be, you know, sort of an open, sort of an operation between some entities that appeared to be non-human and human beings, and they were basically loading some kind of cargo into this craft. He took a number of pictures of this thing, and that he jumped, you know, ran back to his truck, jumped in the truck, ran down into the town of Dulce, went to the local drugstore, and excitedly went to the counter and said, "Do you have 1 hour photo processing?" And the fellow said, "Well, yes, we do." And so he excitedly told this guy behind the counter, "I just saw this UFO, you know, meeting some U.S. military trucks, and they were loading cargo into the UFO." And as he's telling this man behind the counter what he had seen and what he'd photographed, the guy just goes pale as a ghost, and without really turning around, he kind of holds his hand in front of him. He points behind him over his shoulder in a way that would prevent anything that was behind him from actually seeing this. And Paul Benowitz looks up, and there's a camera up on the wall. And the man points to the camera without actually pointing over his shoulder and kind of motions with his eyes like, you know, you're being watched. And he tells him, you know, in a very quiet voice, "You need to get out of here right now as fast as you can." And so, you know, Paul took the hint, you know, took the film, ran out to his vehicle, which was kind of a four-wheel drive mobile home kind of thing, like a camper shell on the back of a pickup truck or something. So he takes off, and as he's, you know, maybe 200 yards down the road, he sees a number of vehicles with Air Force, the deep Air Force blue with the yellow Air Force, you know, official Air Force vehicle stencil on the side, come screeching to a halt. These guys jump out of the car and go running into the store. And so he knows immediately that he's in trouble. And as he's just about out of sight, he sees these guys come running back out to the vehicles, and they immediately begin following him. So now he's out in the middle of the wilderness on this road that that travels south from Dulce, going towards, I guess, the central part of the state back to the main highway system. And he's out in the middle of nowhere, and he's really afraid that something awful is going to happen to him. So he decides to sort of take matters into his own hands. He comes around a corner and turns his vehicle so that it basically blocks the highway, jumps out of his vehicle, and he had a 357 Magnum pistol, probably a Smith & Wesson. And he basically stood behind his vehicle, and he had this pistol drawn and ready to go as these Air Force vehicles came around the corner. And they all stopped, looked at him for a while, talked among themselves, and they basically just turned around and left. So at that point, he felt that, you know, he had some degree of safety, but it wasn't too long after that, after he got back to his office, that the same thing happened to him, that his camera was stolen and he never saw the film again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's obvious that, you know, something kind of strange is going on there.
Now, what did you see when you got up there?
Well, that was it. That was the thing that was so strange about it, is that when I got there, by the time I arrived in Dulce, this is after spending part of my afternoon near Aztec looking at what I thought was the crash site of this March 25th, 1948 crash. By the time I got to Dulce, it was nightfall. And so I had a map of the town. I knew where Paul Shepard and some of his crew had gone to get up on top of the Archuleta Mesa. And it was a little dirt road that sort of proceeded north, crossed over a rickety wooden bridge across a stream that runs a little bit to the west and to the north of Dulce, and started up this mountain road. And I got up onto the top of the mesa. There's a little bit of snow on the ground. It was extremely cold out. I had a sleeping bag, and you know, I really couldn't see any evidence that there was any kind of a military operation going on there. Now, remember, this is like February or March, so it's still pretty much winter time.
Yeah.
Very, very cold up there. And so the likelihood of you encountering any kind of bugs, any kind of flying insects, is near zero, especially at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. So I found a clearing, and I pulled the Fiero off the road, you know, got my long johns on, put my sleeping bag out on the ground with sort of an insulator pad to kind of keep me warm. And I'm laying there on the ground. I can't see anything, but there is something flying all around me. There's at least three objects, and I don't know what they are, but all I can tell you is that if you've ever had a mosquito kind of fly up and land near your ear, that really high-pitched buzzing mm-hmm. sound that you hear, that's the sound that I'm hearing hovering and moving all around me while I'm laying there on the ground. It was the spookiest thing you can imagine, because I could not see a thing. Perfectly clear night, moonless night, beautiful star. I mean, more stars than you can imagine, because there's no light pollution or anything from Dulce. And yet, you know, I mean, I even took a swat, you know, at the open air around me when I thought one of these things came close to me. And I just caught air, nothing else. But I had the distinct feeling that there was some kind of several objects that were hovering around me. And it was really kind of an unnerving experience. And when I would get into the car and roll up the windows, you wouldn't hear it. So it was obviously something in the environment, something that was unseen. But at the same time, it was, you know, something that was obviously paying attention to my presence there. And at one point, a large truck went rumbling by on the roadway. I couldn't really determine whether it was, you know, a civilian truck with, you know, some of the local rednecks out, you know, poking around in the middle of the night, or whether it was a military vehicle. It was just simply too dark. But, you know, I was there for probably 2 hours, and it became more than I can really tolerate.
So you had to get up and get out of it.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, I thought about just sitting in the car and watching the sky, but it was just so bone-chilling cold that I basically jumped in the car and I left Dulce.
Okay, Mark, I appreciate you taking time to talk to me today about all of this. Incredible stories. In finishing this, let's wrap it up by, first of all, Aztec. You went to the crash site. You think something probably happened there, right?
It certainly looked like there had been some activity there. you know, the, like I say, this large block of cement that looked as though it had either been used to cover something up or been used as a foundation for some kind of a crane or some kind of a physical support for moving components during the disassembly of this craft and the transport, you know, on back roads up to, you know, military installation to be transported off to Wright-Patterson. Yeah, so it looked like something had happened there quite a long time ago.
And poking around Area 51, the only thing that was bad that happened to you is you got some speeding ticket.
Yes.
And on top of Enchilada Mesa, in Dulce, you had these strange insect noises, even though it was freezing cold. And you got the hell out of there.
It's, you know, like 25 degrees, and it's middle of the night. Way too cold. I mean, insects, anything below about 45 degrees, and they just almost go completely dormant. They don't fly. They just sit there. And but, you know, there was obviously something moving above ground in the air around me, something I could not see, but I could clearly hear it. I mean, you know, and it wasn't just sort of a generalized buzzing sound in the area that was inexplicable. It was actually like there was a point source from the sound. You could actually hear that it was a unique point of emanation for the sound moving around me. Obviously not close enough for me to actually reach out and touch, but loud enough that I could hear it. It was just an extremely high frequency, like the sound of mosquito wings when something's, you know, something like that's coming up to land.
Cold night like that, did you look around for some vents?
Vents?
Yeah, I mean, warm air coming out from the ground. I've always heard reports of vents up
there. No, in fact, I did look for things like that, and I didn't see anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not a thing.
Mark McCandlish, it was a great show. Thanks for being on. We'll do it again.
Okay, Jerry. Appreciate it.
I'm Jerry Pippin. Our web producer is Jane Swartley. Until next time, thank you for listening. Cheers.